The Bookhouse is an independent bookstore with two locations in New Jersey, Millburn and Long Branch. Are you the guy who says they like to support indie bookstores? Good. Then be that guy. Come shop at The Bookhouse. Books, puzzles, games, coffee, cards, live author events, comedy nights, and most important, a real sense of community where actual human beings engage with one another. The Bookhouse in downtown Millburn and at Pier Village in Long Branch. That's The Bookhouse. Independent, local, quaint as fuck. Follow us on Instagram and come visit our stores.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Book and Film Globe podcast. I am your host, Neil Pollack, the greatest living American writer and the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe. You can find us at www.bookandfilmglobe.com. And if you like the show, and I know you do, please like us or leave us a review or a comment on Spotify or Apple Music or wherever you happen to listen to this show. I would certainly appreciate it. Sea of Reeds Media would certainly appreciate it. And we will continue to bring you fine coverage of cultural matters week in and week out until the end of time, until we live in time, which is one of the movies that I'm going to be talking to Stephen Garrett about this week. I'm going to have only Stephen Garrett on the show this week. Let's switch it up and not even pretend that this isn't Stephen Garrett's show as well as mine. He is our chief film critic, and we're going to talk about five movies. The aforementioned Dreadful We Live in Time, which will be coming up at the end of the show. We're also going to talk about The Apprentice, which is a terrific biopic about young Donald Trump that is in theaters now and very appropriate for election season. A couple of pulpy franchise movies, Smile 2 and Venom, The Last Dance, which are both in theaters now. But first, I'm going to discuss with Stephen Conclave, which is a bizarre papal selection melodrama that has a quality film imprimatur about it, but it really is kind of a silly movie. I liked it more than Stephen did. Stephen will be here after this Conclave trailer to discuss the movie with me, and then we're going to talk about a bunch of other movies as well.
The Pope is dead.
The throne is vacant.
We're about to choose the most famous man in the world.
Another cardinal has turned up. Was never on our list.
He has to be an imposter.
No sane man would want the papacy.
The men who are dangerous are the ones who do want it.
You should be careful, Thomas.
It is fall movie season, and we have a lot of movies to get to, so I've got Stephen Garrett to get to movies with me. Stephen is talking to me from a car in Sunnyvale, California, where he is currently on the free Google Wi-Fi that is provided for the whole town.
Hello, and I'm on Chrome, so I'm very
Google-ish. I have Google Fiber here at home. This podcast is not brought to you by Google, by the way. It is brought to you by Sea of Reeds Media.
But I'm brought to you by Google today.
Well, anyway, we're going to hop right to it because we've got a bunch of movies to talk about, Stephen. Let's start with a movie that you saw on the film festival circuit, and I just saw about an hour ago. It's called Conclave, and it is basically a melodrama about the selection of the new pope. Not the actual new pope, it's a fictional film, but it's set in a papal conclave.
Yeah, it's quite the potboiler. I thought this would be a lot more serious and substantial than it was, and I'm not saying that's a bad thing. It's kind of a fun, pulpy, ridiculous movie with a real sucker punch of an ending that kind of had me laughing as much as I was reeling. I was like, seriously? It's a big eye roll for me. I don't know. I was like, fun to watch, but everybody's chewing up the scenery. And
it gets pulpier and pulpier as it goes on. You know, it sort of begins like you're watching some sort of very serious, realistic movie about the process of papal selection. And as it goes on, it just gets more and more kind of melodramatic. It's based on a popular novel. You know, this is not some kind of historical document.
Right, exactly.
So, you know, and here's the thing. Like, it's directed by Edward Berger, who directed last year's All Quiet on the Western Front, which is an Oscar nominee.
Which I thought was an overrated. Did you like it?
Yeah, well, it was so depressing. It's hard to like.
But how do you remake, All Quiet on the Western Front is one of the great anti-war movies and one of the great anti-war books and has been around forever. And I don't begrudge somebody maybe doing their own take on it, but this was so vanilla. It was so banal, what he did. I didn't feel like he brought anything new to it. nor do I feel like he's bringing anything to this. It's kind of generic prestige, his Edward Berger's Lane. It strikes me. I don't know.
Maybe. Although I will say this, that in the hands of a less generic prestige director, Conclave could have been awful.
Fair. This was not awful. It just was kind of silly, but took itself quite seriously.
Sort of. It took itself seriously. It had a lot of prestige actors in it. Ralph Fiennes is the main character, sure to get many nominations, playing the manager of the papal conclave, who is undergoing. He's like a cardinal detective, basically.
He's kind of a cardinal detective, and he brings more gravitas than that role should really have.
Maybe.
You know, as does, you know, John Lithgow to a certain extent. Stanley Tucci is just Stanley Tucci. He's watching him drink Negronis in the back, you know. I don't know.
Stanley Tucci did this role in between tours, culinary tours of Puglia or whatever.
He also has lines like, that'll make him the Richard Nixon of popes.
No, he said, I would be the Richard Nixon of popes.
I would be the Richard Nixon of popes, exactly. Sergio Castellito being the nefarious, I guess, very conservative Italian cardinal.
He's just the right wing. There are liberal cardinals. There are conservative cardinals. There's lots of, boy, these guys are really scarred with scandal.
Ugh, lots of scandals.
So many scandals. But not the scandals you'd expect, like the scandals that have actually tarred the Catholic Church, like, oh, he molested children, or, oh, he was a Nazi. None of that.
No.
Just more sort of petty corruption.
Yeah, secret children out of wedlock, whatever.
That sort of thing. We can't give away the ending. The ending is so absurd. I spat up my Coke Zero. I couldn't believe it.
I just love that Ralph Fiennes, that shot of his face as he processes the ending. It's literally like he's going like, are you serious? I have to sell this now to the audience? Like, what? He's reeling.
To the audience and to the Cardinals. So,
and to the Cardinals. I mean, there's also like you mentioned the big ending. Of course, it involves this cardinal named Cardinal Benitez, who's this like mystery archbishop or cardinal who pops up unexpectedly. Almost like the uninvited guest at the murder mystery, you know? So yeah. You're like, obviously something portentous is going to happen with this guy. And this guy going from nowhere suddenly is getting more and more votes. And you're just like, all right, something's clearly going to pay off with this guy. I mean, it's really, yeah, I wouldn't say the most clever plotting, right? I felt like this guy was being teed up pretty early.
I don't know. Here's the thing. Like, I mean, I think I enjoyed Conclave a bit more than you did, but based on the returns from the film festivals, I expected this to be the absolute like prestige blockbuster. It's something along the lines of of Spotlight, you know, right. Something along the lines of that. Like, but Spotlight, which won Best Picture. Conclave is not going to win Best Picture. It's just too silly.
I think it's like the Umberto Eco school of filmmaking, right? Like, this is kind of in the name of the rose for, you know, today's audiences. It's like prestige, but pulpy. It's a popular entertainment, which I don't begrudge. I think there should be more popular entertainments that aspire to be highbrow, but this is far short of sophisticated or profound, I found.
Which is funny, because it's really a movie. It's supposed to be a movie about faith and religion, corruption in the Catholic Church. And yeah. It is as silly and pulpy as anything you're going to see on screens. All right, so that's Conclave.
But can I add a quick thing real fast? In what universe are the top three of the top five cardinals in contention to be Pope? One's a Brit, one's Canadian, and one's American. No, never, ever. What?
Right. Right. This isn't like Olympic sprinting.
Anyway, right. That's my two cents.
Fair enough. All right. So let's move on to something that had no artistic aspirations, and that is Venom, The Last Dance.
I'm giving you a chance, sweetie.
Let's go. We've come a long way, you and me. But now my own hunting us.
This world can't survive if you stay together.
Now we're going to be the lethal protector.
That's what this is.
Let's finish this.
Why is it called The Last Dance?
Say The Last Dance for me. I think they try to set up Venom as a sort of part of his hokiness and his fun is that he will cut loose. He loves to sing and party. There was a scene in the second Venom movie where he and Eddie, his bro, it's a bromance, right? Over three movies. they have a falling out. And so he's like, I'm out of the Eddie closet. And so he goes to a rave and dances the night away. And you're just like, what? And in this movie, there's a scene where he...
As Venom?
As Venom. But it's like conveniently Halloween. So everybody just thinks he's in a really cool costume. Mm. And then in this movie, it's in Vegas. And they bump into, preposterously, one of their acquaintances, this woman, Mrs. Chen, who knows about Venom, and they can all be comfortable talking about it. She apparently is on, she's a great gambler, apparently, and she got a penthouse hotel room, you know, kind of gifted to her or whatever. So there's this big dance sequence to ABBA where she's dancing with Venom. You're just like, what? Why? So that's the last dance. I have no idea. But it is the last hurrah, you know, for now.
For this franchise.
Tom Hardy, who's a really fantastic British actor and has a great intensity when he plays kind of laddies or like kind of big burly guys. Here he plays kind of a schlubbish average Joe, you know, kind of reporter in the Bay Area. And, you know, he's like, hey, how you doing? You know, Venom, what are you doing? What, you know, and Venom is like, we must bite people's heads off. I mean, it's preposterous. But it, like you were saying, this movie knows what kind of movie it is. It is nothing if not fun. And it doesn't overstay its welcome. It's a little over an hour and a half, you know, hour 45. You're in, you're out. A lot of goofy deaths and violence and space monsters. There's a big bad villain named Krull. What's Krull? Null. Silent K. K-N-U-L-L. Null. He's one of these universe destroyers who's been locked up and he's trying to... The MacGuffin is that Eddie Brock and the symbiote Venom, together combined, have some sort of what they call the Codex, which is the key to unlocking this guy's prison. And he's been imprisoned by the symbiotes for 280 million years. And this, if his little minions track down Venom and Eddie and take the Codex, then it will unlock this guy and he will destroy the entire universe.
It sounds very similar to the plot of Conclave, honestly.
But it
sounds like, it sounds to me like, and it's very CGI heavy, sounds like the Godzilla v. Kongification of this storyline, which started out as like a kind of a very simple story, right? And yeah. Then it is blown up into this broad universe thing.
It's a weird thing where I guess they just felt like they had to raise the stakes like every Marvel movie needs to. And this is like... I mean, this is fringe Marvel, right? This is almost like alt Marvel because like from the get-go in the first movie, I thought was terrible. The second had a Looney Tunes kind of energy and vibrancy to it and had a sense of humor about itself. It was not trying to be anything big and splashy. But where does Venom fit in your dance card when it comes to Marvel characters?
You know, this is not a franchise that I'm enamored with. This Venom is a side character, a side Spider-Man villain that was shunted off, that was not purchased by Marvel, Disney, whatever. So it's one of these Sony products. So Sony's just kind of emptying out the library. You know, they've produced two of the worst movies of all time, Morbius and that M. Web.
Oh, that's right.
You know, and then there's got this Kraven the Hunter thing coming out later this year, which looks to be just as bad. You know, the Venom movies are quality. This is like masterpiece theater compared to the other stuff that Sony's putting out. These are like Merchant Ivory movies.
Yeah, exactly. I think what's great, I mean, Tom Hardy's a smart, certainly a very intuitive actor, and he's not a fool. And I think he likes to cut loose and play characters. And I think this very much is a reflection of his attitude. Also, this woman, Kelly Marcel, I think, is the director of it. But she co-wrote and co-produced all of the Venom movies, and she has known Tom Hardy apparently since before either of them were working in Hollywood, so or in movies. And so I think there's a rapport there and a looseness that makes it fun.
So you're saying there's an auteur behind the Venom franchise?
I guess there's an auteur. There's certainly some sort of auteurist voice that makes it all palatable. But getting back to your point about Sony having the rights to Spider-Man. When Marvel was shopping its sad little box of characters around in the 90s and nobody wanted to buy it, you know, Sony cherry-picked Spider-Man and said, we'll buy the rights to Spider-Man. We don't care about all these other crazy characters like Iron Man or Thor. Who cares? And then, of course, you know, things changed. The fortunes changed for Marvel. And Marvel has been desperate to get Marvel Disney, wants Spider-Man back really bad. And they did some horse trading to allow Spider-Man to be in, like, the Avengers movies and things like that. But Sony owns it. And the reason Sony continues to own it is there's a loop. I don't know. Do you know this contract loop? If Sony goes more than 2 years without a Spider-Man movie, and that includes peripheral characters, then the rights revert back to Marvel.
There we go. That's why we keep getting these Venom movies. Although we're done with Venom, and we have who knows? Who knows what's coming next? But these have been a specialty of yours, these Venom movies. I remember how you hated the first one. It's one of the biggest pans I've seen you give a movie in the.
It was pretty odious, and it's interesting because I think even they would admit that there was a tonal issue with the first movie, and it was hard for them to get the sense, the kind of cartoony, approachable sense of fun. And they did it with the second movie. It's a lot more fun.
Maybe you've just been taken over by a symbiote. Have you thought about that?
I might have been taken over by a symbiote. I will say this is a movie that feels like it has a lot of subplots that were probably cut out in the cutting room when they were putting it together. Because there's a lot of stuff that just gets set up and doesn't really, there's no follow through. And right. Then the movie ends and you're like, okay, I don't care anyway. It's fine.
All right, let's move along to another franchise movie that you reviewed last week. This is a franchise on the rise, I would say. You talked about you wrote about Smile 2.
I keep seeing this face everywhere.
This thing is a parasite.
You're not in control.
Sort of a horror suspense franchise that seems to be, it's like gaining steam with this second one. It was a huge hit.
Yeah. I mean, I think what's interesting about Smile and Smile 2, there's a character who is at the end of the last movie, rather the first movie. And then this new movie starts with that character, but it's connective tissue, but it's almost like the Exquisite Corpse, right? Is that when you're a room full of people and everybody has to keep the story going and it goes in different directions? I don't think there needs to be a sort of Michael Myers character or Freddy Krueger character for Smile. There is this unknown phantasmagorical evil spirit that invades people, and it's almost like The Ring, where you have 7 days or so that you're possessed, and then you end up killing yourself. And you kill, I think you get infected if you watch somebody with the spirit kill themselves in front of you and you witness it, then that spirit then invades your body.
And then when you have this virus, psychological virus, then you see people make these evil smiles at you.
Yeah, exactly. Now, maybe that's a manifestation of the phantasm looking as though they're possessing that person or not, or maybe it's hallucination. The movie doesn't really make that clear, but it's very much falling into the sort of, you know, Nightmare on Elm Street vibe of you're watching a scene and you think it's reality and then you realize it's a dream or it's some sort of, you know, weird hallucination. But I think the key to both these movies, Smile and Smile 2, is that it really leans into the psychology of horror, where someone is troubled or haunted about something in their life that's unresolved, or they're tortured about some other sort of psychological aspect of their life, and the phantasm amplifies it. So the people are tortured by their own sort of psychoses, whatever they're troubled by.
And the protagonist of Smile 2 is like a major pop star, like a Lady Gaga. Is she Lady Raven from the
She's
movie
Lady
Trap?
She's Lady Raven. Yeah, from Trap. I mean, you know, it's the New York Times actually had a pretty great article kind of pointing out that we went from, you know, Taylor Swift Eras Tour concert, you know, which was all smiles and rainbows, to these two movies seemingly back to back just in the past few months, where both in Trap and in Smile 2, it is actually a hellish landscape. It's like a hellscape if you're a pop star, because there's so much pressure on your shoulders. You've got psychos who are trying to kill you or ghosts trying to possess you. But yeah, apparently it's no fun being a pop star.
Wasn't there, there was that Natalie Portman movie a few years ago, Vox Lux, that it kind of had,
the
same vibe. So I think we all, and of course, the Andy Samberg vehicle, Pop Star, Never Stopping, which is the best pop star movie ever made, I think.
Also the Elton John movie, Rocket Man, where it's basically this sad story about, like, sex and drugs and rock and roll are actually really sad. And Elton John has actually not been a happy man in his astronomical success in his musicianship.
All right, so but Smile.
But Smile, yeah, I was just going to add what you had said before, which is this actually is a pretty promising franchise because it's plug and play. They have a template, but they can make it, instead of a pop star, it could be a politician next time. It could be anything where somebody under a lot of pressure, when possessed, freaks out and has a nervous breakdown, and then you see the effects of that in whatever vocation that person has.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I it's been well documented that I don't particularly like horror on this show, but this is a very clever concept, and this isn't like heavy gore, right?
It actually is. There's some pretty disgusting moments. This one, I think, gorier than the first, but the first was pretty gory. I think there is a sense that the one thing about this movie is that there's a slow burn mentality and a jump scare mentality that kind of overstays its welcome, where you get kind of exhausted. Like, these movies are, the first one is a solid 2 hours. This one's over 2 hours, and it shouldn't be. Like, this is just, take a cue from Venom. Keep it short. Have fun, you know?
Right. Or take a cue from 1980s horror franchises, where those movies were always at 97 minutes long.
Exactly. Friday the 13th was not a long film.
Right. Right. So, you know, this is not an Ari Aster movie, right? This is a pulpy Final Destination kind of horror franchise.
It is. But it's funny you mention that, because I think there's a sense, I think, what's his name, Finn Parker or something, the director, has a bit of a sort of Ari Aster complex, or maybe he's trying to be. That their aspirations there. Not quite. Good try. But it's still, there's something there. It's a great concept and it's fun to watch.
All right. That's Smile 2. Let's move on to a couple movies I've actually seen. For a switch. All right. So we are mercifully nearing the end of election season. I think you and I can both agree that enough is enough already. And the sort of the political movie of the year, as far as I'm concerned, is The Apprentice.
This is Donald Trump from Mr. Cohn.
Donald who?
People, they hire me because I'm a winner.
How do you win?
You have to be willing to do anything to win.
Have a look at yourself. You're getting ugly.
I know what I'm doing.
I made you.
We have a brand new campaign slogan. Let's make America great again.
Well, I like the again part.
It's actually very popular abroad, not in the United States. In the United States, it's proven to be a kind of a tough sell. It's a movie about basically like, it's a Donald Trump origin story. It's about young Donald Trump's relationship with evil political fixer Roy Cohn. You know, I think I love this movie. I thought it was just an absolutely fantastic film. I can see why it's not popular in the States, because, you know, MAGA people aren't going to like it, because it doesn't really make Donald Trump look good. And I would say that anti-Trump people aren't going to like it, because it makes Trump look too good. It sort of humanizes him.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a hit job at all, right? It's a character study. It's an origin story for an anti-hero, which I think is really interesting. Somebody pointed that out, and I thought that was very apt. First of all, Roy Cohn, or let's say Jeremy Strong as Roy Cohn, absolutely deadly. I mean, amazing. I don't know if you loved it as much as I did. Absolutely
phenomenal.
Incredible. Such an evocative, spooky, hilarious, harrowing character. And then ultimately pathetic, because, of course,
yes.
I mean, it's all public record that he dies. First of all, he was a homophobe who was absolutely a homosexual, but very self-hating, in the closet until his death at, you know, of AIDS. And you see his downfall, and you see Trump push him away after he's kind of learned from the best. One of the lessons he learned was also to distance himself, basically, from Roy Cohn.
Yeah, very, 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 very smartly. Strong's performance is just fantastic. Will receive much awards attention when it is time to receive awards attention. I do also think that Sebastian Stan, Bucky Barnes, the Winter Soldier, is really good as
He's
Trump,
good.
Actually.
Well, like, he's not a caricature, is he? I mean, he's not ridiculous. No. He plays it actually kind of understated.
He gets a little ridiculous toward the end when Trump starts to become the Trump we know. Yeah. He's sort of by the end, he's like the Trump that Spy magazine was making fun of in the 80s, right? The quote unquote short fingered vulgarian. But especially, you know, the first half of the movie, when he's sort of like a callow, young, ambitious up and comer, you can see him sort of briefly struggle with some of Roy Cohn's evil lessons.
He struggles with them. He's also browbeat by this, by Fred Trump, who's played by Martin Donovan, and it's fantastic. You actually kind of feel for Trump in really empathetic ways. It's an empathetic film, I think, and Ali Abbasi is the director. Movie is written by Gabriel Sherman. But Ali Abbasi is, I think he's Dutch-Iranian? He's got an outsider's view of this very quintessentially American character, and it's more clinical, his study. It's not a parody.
Yeah, it's not a parody. It is not didactic. And it's just an excellent film. It's very evocative of 1970s and 1980s New York in a very interesting way. And
we should say that this really just spans that gap up through the late 80s. I don't think it goes into the 90s, and it definitely doesn't get into the TV stuff.
It ends with Trump getting ready to write his best-selling book, The Art of the Deal. And it begins with Trump basically as like a bill collector for his slumlord father.
Right.
So we mentioned Martin Donovan and Jeremy Strong and Sebastian Stan. Also, I really liked Maria Bakalova as Ivana Trump, who, and I thought, she really looked the part and also was good without like being an over the top caricature. Really kind of amazing that to my mind, this is one of the best movies of the year, The Apprentice.
And oh, wow. No,
yeah, I loved it. I loved it. It's very strong. It's, naturalistic. It doesn't, unlike the movie we're about to discuss, does not try to mess with the timeline. It just feels very real and it's sad and sort of enraging, but it's also quite funny. And it's just an excellent film, and I couldn't recommend it more highly.
And also, if I could just add too, just from a kind of a filmmaking point of view, I think one of the interesting choices that Ali Abbasi made was almost like a Boogie Nights thing, where it's bifurcated. There's the 70s and the 80s. In the 70s, he shoots in what looks to be 16 millimeter, trying to be, but it looks like film grain, and it's in that kind of handheld, cinema verite style. And then in the 80s, it's all video. It's shot in this video filter.
You are more attuned to that kind of thing than I am. That makes a lot of sense. And but that just adds to the verisimilitude of the film, just really makes it feel real. And I really admire this movie, and I was shocked at how good it was. Really. I didn't really know what to expect. And, I came out of it thinking like, this is going to top my best of list. And I really hope that Strong and Stan, I hope the whole cast get recognized for the.
Yeah, I would be shocked if they can't get Strong at least a nomination for a supporting actor, because it's just incredible.
Oh, for sure, he's so good. Well, he's just like one of the best. He's perhaps maybe the best actor working. He's the most method of our method actors.
He's definitely the most method. Yeah, I'll hand you that.
And he just is Roy Cohn in it. Really, really good stuff. Great. All right. Now let's address the elephant in the room.
The pendulum swings.
The pendulum swings. But first, let's cut to a scene somewhere in the future where I'm dying. No, or maybe let's cut back to my teenage years, or simultaneously talk about how I'm dying and I'm a teenager and also a genius chef. We're talking, of course, about We Live in Time.
What's happened to my underwear?
Boy, I literally have no idea.
So sorry, but do we know each other?
Yeah, no. I ran you over. Sorry.
It's all right.
The weepy romantic drama that really, really a huge, huge bust, starring Andrew Garfield and Florence Pugh. It made the festival circuit. Did they really expect people to like this film, Stephen?
That's a very good question. I think they thought this is one of these old school melodramas that Brits can do quite well when every so often, where it's a great mix of charming and funny and sweet and romantic, and then also kind of devastating.
But it's none of those things. But it's none of those things.
Well, it's just preposterous. I will say the one thing I really loved about it, which I realized I hadn't really seen. we're watching Florence Pugh and Andrew Garfield acting in a film set in the present day with their actual native British accents.
That's true.
And they're not in some costume, and they're not a superhero, and they're not trying to be anything, but they are. So they're normies, which I think is hilarious. Albeit one of the normies is a former figure skating, now professional, Michelin starred chef.
Yeah, yeah, she's not. Yeah, Florence Pugh is not just a chef. First of all, enough with the chefs and TV shows and movies. But
yes, chef. No chef.
No chef. She's not just a chef. She's a Michelin star chef. She's a genius chef. She's a chef who is somehow in training on the main British team in the Bocuse d'Or competition, even though she's actually dying of cancer while she's dying of cancer. And okay, stupid, right? But the real problem with this movie is like she's like a superhuman. And not only that, she has like lots of friends. She's a large, loving, supportive family. She's obviously well-respected, well-loved. And all right, I'm just going to say it. I don't care. No one's going to see this movie anyway. She hits this guy with her car.
Oh, right.
And the guy is Andrew Garfield, and he is a mid-level executive at Weetabix, which is the only really kind of clever touch in the film, and he's very sad.
It's a very Richard Curtis touch, I have to say. It's like Hugh Grant would have had that job in the 90s, right?
Right, but he's very sad. He's going through a divorce. She hits him with her car. Oh, let's add, too, that Florence Pugh's character is basically a lesbian, or she's at least bisexual, you know, or last major
relationship. Yeah, I don't get the attraction.
Right. Well, he has no, you know, he's just the weepy beta male. And
he's a weepy
beta. And, you know.
Yeah. And he's getting divorced, I think.
Yeah, he's getting divorced because he wants kids, and his careerist wife doesn't, and Florence Pugh doesn't want kids, but most of the movie is like, it's either Florence Pugh cooking or vomiting, or it's Andrew Garfield crying in the bathtub surrounded by candles.
There's literally a scene
where his father, who also is a widowed beta male, is shaving his neck while he's in the bathtub. And I saw this more recently than you did.
I blacked it out.
Yeah, I don't blame you. His father is is the only person who appears to know Andrew. It's almost like Andrew Garfield is a ghost.
Certainly doesn't have any friends. I mean, he goes over and sees her, and she's hanging out with all of her
friends.
Let's face it, lesbian friends. They're all women. They're no boys.
Yeah.
And he comes in, and it's super awkward. And he talks about how she broke his heart because she didn't want kids, but then he's forgiving her. And that apparently makes her love him more. What?
And then we know that they have a kid because we see... But this another thing that's really horrible about this movie is that it's completely all out of narrative order. We see scenes in a certain time, and then a few years ago, and then there's this kid, very normal girl, but you know, and they're living in this very expensive farmhouse in the country, and it's just such weepy nonsense, and I'm just like, is this what millennials are like? What's wrong with these people?
I don't know. It's a great example too. I mean, A24 produced this, and these guys usually have a great track record. And sometimes, maybe the films on paper with the talent that they have attached don't quite work out the way I think they were thinking it would. And I would imagine this is that sort of situation, because there are some interesting things about it that could have made it better. But I think a big tell whenever a movie has shuffled the chronology of events is a sleight of hand to make it seem like that movie's a lot more interesting than it is. Because if you put this chronologically, there's just no there. It's really pretty banal.
I would rather have seen it chronologically, because then at least you get to see the tragedy unfold.
Yeah.
The only scene I liked, and you know, my one's mileage might vary on the scene, is the scene where Florence Pugh gives birth to their daughter in a petrol station restroom, because there's a traffic jam and they can't get to the hospital, which is kind of a cliche, but at least like there's sort of a visceralness to the scene, which is, you know,
absolutely kind of, it's one of those scenes where you're just like, oh my god, are they really, oh wow, they're going for it, and they do.
Yeah.
In the film, like, it's really pretty graphic in a way that is funny and real and kind of heartwarming.
Yeah, definitely the best scene in the movie. It's not a saving grace, but it, they don't flash away from it either. We just kind of like, for once, get to sit there with these characters and go through their absurd life circumstances. There's also like, there's a lot of nudity in the movie. I mean, and I like, don't mind seeing Florence Pugh naked, mind you, but it's kind of like, there's a lot of Florence Pugh naked and you don't even see Andrew Garfield's butt.
He's very demure. He's a little shy.
I imagine he might cry in the bathtub if he had to.
That's where you saw his naked shoulders and upper chest.
It's definitely like a movie written and directed by a man, because it's like Florence Pugh is this superwoman who gives it all up more or less kind of for this guy who has no personality and is just very sad because he really wants a baby. And I'm like, what is the mentality of the filmmaker and the writer that they would create such a story?
It's the Weetabix of romantic dramas.
Yeah, it's very milk soaked. It's a very, very, you know, I compared it to, like, in my review, which I'm sure you haven't seen, One Day, which was a film starring Anne Hathaway, but it's also.
Oh, yeah. I remember that one. Yeah. I didn't see the remake of it, but I, yeah.
Oh, I did. I actually watched the whole thing and it was excellent and very, very, very sad. But it was earned because you watched the, you know, and there was a little bit of time jumping, but you saw these characters develop over the decades.
I liked
it. And it was very realistic, and you know, and this is like this kind of like a, it's, this is like one day for dummies, and it really, to me, like this movie should, there should be an international accords to ban nonlinear narratives after We Live in Time.
Wow, and of course there's the famous carousel horse, which was making the rounds.
Yeah, the yellow carousel horse with the buck teeth that is now my Facebook profile picture.
I think that will outlive anything that dies in We Live in Time.
Indeed. All right. Well, Stephen Garrett, you are in a car. Get out of my show and into your car. I will talk to you very soon. Thanks for talking to me about all the movies that are currently at the movies.
Lightning round. Yeah, we did a good job. I hope we're under the wire there, but always a pleasure.
And clear. All right, Stephen Garrett, thank you so much. This was Neil and Stephen at the Movies or some such thing. We haven't really branded it yet, but we talked about five films. We talked about Conclave, Venom the Last Dance, Smile 2, The Apprentice, and We Live in Time. Your miles may vary on these films, but I really like The Apprentice, and I kind of like Conclave for what it was. But The Apprentice is the winner, as far as I'm concerned, in this particular film sweepstakes. I am Neil Pollack. I am your host. I am the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. I host this podcast. Please like us. Please leave us a comment. Please continue to listen to the show and tell people who love quality cultural programming about us. I will talk to you next week, unless it's already next week, or maybe it's a year from now, or maybe I'm 12 years old again. I don't know. I live in time. I'll talk to you soon. Audio
Original production. The Bookhouse is an independent bookstore with two locations in New Jersey, Millburn and Long Branch. Are you the guy who says they like to support indie bookstores? Good. Then be that guy. Come shop at The Bookhouse. Books, puzzles, games, coffee, cards, live author events, comedy nights, and most important, a real sense of community where actual human beings engage with one another. The Bookhouse in downtown Millburn and at Pier Village in Long Branch. That's The Bookhouse. Independent, local, quaint as fuck. Follow us on Instagram and come visit our stores.